If you've watched the Netflix series Stranger Things, the young protagonists are playing Dungeons and Dragons. The show is set in the 80s, and the choice of game seems fittingly retro. Let's take a listen.
Mom, we're in the middle of a campaign.
You mean the end? 15 after.
Oh, my God. Oh, you idiot.
You have to go.
Mom, wait. Just 20 more minutes.
School night, Michael.
I just put Holly to bed. You can finish next weekend.
But then I'll ruin the flow.
Michael.
I'm serious, Mom. The campaign took 2 weeks to plan. How was I supposed to know it was going to take 10 hours?
You've been playing for 10 hours?
But a show set in 2017 could just as easily feature a group of friends playing D&D and getting lost in a world of heroes, fantasy, and adventure.
Nima Jaromi works on the editorial staff of The New Yorker, where he writes about the intersection of culture, philosophy, and politics, and he recently wrote about the somewhat unexpected resurgence of people playing D&D. Nima, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. I have to say I feel both humble and intimidated to be speaking on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oh, we're really easygoing here in Wisconsin. Nothing to worry about.
You're in Gygax country.
That's true. We are in large part the origin, the birthplace of Dungeons and Dragons. So for people who haven't played it, Nima, and haven't watched Stranger Things, can you give us a D&D 101? How does it work as a game?
So I think the first thing to say is that it is not a card game. A lot of people mix it up with Magic the Gathering.
Sure.
But it is basically there's players usually between 3 and 6 and a dungeon master who's sort of describing what happens, saying, you know, you're walking in a forest, or you wake up in bed, or you're all in a tavern drinking, and then asks the players what they like to do, and then they sort of describe it aloud. And if they want to try and trick somebody or intimidate somebody or fight them, swing a sword or a club, it's in a fantasy setting. They have to roll a 20-sided die, and getting a higher number means that you might be more successful in doing what you try to do. And then the dungeon master will reveal the consequences, and over hours you start to build out a story that you've kind of all created collectively, and it's mainly happening in your own heads.
Now, this got big in the 70s and into the 80s. I played it back then. And as you look at entertainment nowadays, you know, we've got computers and gadgets. We can play games kind of like this. We have so many electronic media. It might seem like this is something that would fall by the wayside. But you write, no, in many ways, it's had a revival, if anything.
Right. I mean, and I think that a big part of that revival is just people feeling that you don't need to take every piece of technology and exploit it and make it as naturalistic and all-consuming as you possibly can. Even in video games, there are sort of these lighter touch games, clicker games, and things like that that people are really engaged with. And I think that part of that is just sort of that they let you, there's a pleasure in kind of straining your imagination. You know, people still read poetry and go to plays when you could be sitting with a virtual reality headset on your head all the time. And I think that, you know, every kind of level of technology in terms of gaming is its own aesthetic in a way.
And you profiled some people who play and who even started up almost businesses around this, hosting games. And as they delved more into it, it seemed like there's a real hunger for doing this activity that harnessed both creativity and sort of that sociability, bringing people together.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I talked to the clinical psychologist, John Freeman, who runs a gaming store now. You know, he was mainly doing other kinds of board games until people started to get really interested in Dungeons and Dragons. And now there's been this cultural moment along this zeitgeist that has many causes that I think he and a lot of other gaming stores and various businesses have been able to capitalize on. And it's really, I mean, it's a great phenomenon. I mean, I think, you know, there's a way in which everything old is new again. But there's lots of different reasons that I think have to do with our particular moment for why it's so popular today.
I think the part of the story is probably people like me who played in our teens now have money to go out and buy the games again, or new versions or old versions, and nostalgia, though it is a lot easier to get a group of 15-year-olds together than a group of 40-somethings together to do something on a regular basis.
Right. I mean, that clip you were playing where they're talking about playing for 10 hours, I run a game like we meet every week or every other week, and we all sort of wish, you know, we're going through one of the published campaigns and we're looking at finishing it about a year. Whereas if you're, you know, a 14-year-old kid and you have the whole summer, you can play 10 hours every day as long as, you know, your mom or dad doesn't stop you, and you can get through a lot more story. but yeah, no, I mean, it's great. And then I think the longevity of the game has brought a lot of people from different generations together to at least talk about the game, if not even play together.
And you write that it's being used sometimes therapeutically, helping kids express themselves, talk about trauma, difficulties in their life, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and it's interesting, and it's not, I mentioned just in general, being able to talk to kids who are having a difficult time. It's a great therapeutic device. It also is good for kids with autism because, you know, sometimes that structure of a world where you can, where there are options and that are more sort of, that can be more clearly defined if you want them to be, makes it easier to talk about sort of psychological and emotional issues, but it can work for, you know, I spoke to a rancher in Montana who is sort of troubled by all the news, and especially so much of what's happened politically in the last year and a half, and he's at work trying to build a really elaborate campaign using Dungeons and Dragons as a way to kind of unspool his thoughts about the present moment. And I think that, you know, if you can fit things almost allegorically into these categories, it can be helpful. It makes them a little bit more sort of bite-sized and limited and easier to confront.
And I love you had an anecdote about people talking about a session they were playing and no phones allowed, and in the middle of it, somebody pulled out a phone and saw the latest political headline and started to say it out loud, and people were like, no, not here, not now.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think that, well, for one thing, it's the game, for people who haven't played it, can be somewhat intimidating because you have to think on your feet. You know, it's not like responding to an email or a tweet where, you know, you can sit there and compose it and delete it and draft it. It's real time. You have to talk. And that only becomes really, truly engaging when people are focused just on the game. And, you know, I mean, my players will sometimes look at their phones, and it's not like I'm chiding them or anything, but I think the ideal form of the game takes place in real time when people are talking to each other and can look each other in the eye, see each other's emotions, that kind of thing.
Well, an amazing thing as a gaming person myself, board games and role-playing when I can, the internet didn't kill this. It made it more available. Now you can buy all the stuff on PDF and look up that rule you don't understand online. In some ways, the internet has made the non-internet stuff easier to get into.
Well, yeah, and absolutely. And people, of course, a huge number of people play online on various platforms, the platforms that sort of even maintain the rules so you don't have to think about them as much. But I think what's interesting is that even when people are using these digital tools, they're still doing something lower-fi and lower-tech than playing a more advanced game like Shadows of Mordor or something like that, which is based on The Lord of the Rings, which, you know, would have all these graphics and things. There's still that work your imagination has to do.
Nima, I'll jump in. We'll leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
That's Nima Jaromi. He's on the editorial staff of The New Yorker. He recently wrote about why people are returning, maybe in greater numbers now, to non-computer games like Dungeons and Dragons.
Coming up, we'll find out how Republican tax proposals would affect lower and middle income Americans. I'm Jake Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.